good to know.
Welcome to the Babbelry,
where translators visit the Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
The Tower of Babel.
Babel.
Babbelry.
It's hard to do politically, but compared to, you know, giving women the vote or ending slavery, like it's not, we've solved harder problems.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. The internet has been a gift to women. Our ability to exchange information, explore shared interests, and support each other has been revolutionized. At the same time, the internet has been the largest single driver of misogyny and abuse humanity has ever seen. These contradictions leave women grasping for answers. I spoke to my guest, Cindy Cohen of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, before the latest story of internet-aided abuse broke, but it's on my mind now. Tens of thousands of men shared tips and product advice for men who wanted to drug and rape their own wives. Tens of thousands of men shared videos of the attacks, and millions viewed the content. These numbers are the lowest, most conservative estimate of the problem. Yet when the story broke, men online immediately circled their wagons and told women we were overreacting. We aren't overreacting. We are reacting to being reminded again that the internet is not just a mirror of our world. It's a magnifier. Just as people with good intentions have found ways to exchange information, explore shared interests, and support each other, people with the worst intentions have done the same.
Hi, my name is Cindy Cohen. I'm the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We do free speech, privacy, and innovation online. I've been the executive director for 11 years, and I'm also the author of a new book called Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance. And I'm the co-host of BFF's award-winning podcast, How to Fix the Internet.
Cindy Cohen has been at the forefront of internet-related legal challenges since before most Americans even had an email address. I was intensely curious how, as a woman and a fierce advocate for freedom of speech and privacy on the internet, she would frame the challenges that women face online. In this conversation, you will hear Cindy's firm argument for the principles she's espoused in her legal career, and you'll also hear a frank discussion of the challenges women face, both in the real world and online. But we won't stick with the bad stuff, because it's the good that keeps lawyers like Cindy fighting for women's place online. I started by asking Cindy, somewhat facetiously, how to fix the internet in 100 words or less, and she rose to the challenge.
We didn't get into the problems with the internet with just one thing, so there isn't just one quick fix, but there are a few things we could do that would make things much better, and the first is comprehensive privacy protection.
Listen in for a fascinating deep dive into privacy, freedom of speech, and how one woman believes that women can stand for those rights while also insisting on real solutions for the harm they are facing in the world and online. First, let's learn what the Electronic Frontier Foundation does.
EFF is the world's oldest and largest digital rights organization. We work to make sure when you go online, your rights go with you. So that gets us involved in protecting your privacy, also in free speech issues and in innovation issues. And we have kind of three segments of EFF. The first segment is a bunch of lawyers. We do lawsuits and we lobby. We work in the legislature and other places. The second is technologists who both develop some privacy protecting technologies, but also advise the rest of us and make sure we're right about how the technology works. And the third is a set of activists who do things like help you, you know, make your voice heard, whether that's to a member of Congress or to your local school board or other places. They're really the kind of people who help organize folks to really stand up for their own rights.
So I feel like we need to get sort of a baseline, which is what privacy and freedom of speech are and what the major issues are with online privacy.
So I think of privacy as maybe a little different than some people do. Some people think of privacy like the Harry Potter invisibility cloak that you throw over your head, you know, when you're about to do something you don't want, you know, somebody else to find out about it. Well, you know, privacy does that. I'm not saying it doesn't. But the way that I think, the reason I think privacy is important and far more important than that is because privacy is a way that people with less power can have a zone of protection from people who have more power. And I think about this from the very smallest to the very biggest level. On the very smallest level, my colleague, Eva Galperin, works with domestic violence victims, almost, you know, a lot of women. And what did they find out? They find out that their abusers have put malware on their devices so that they can track them all the time, so that they don't have any privacy against their abusers. And they need privacy in order to plot their escape, in order to literally protect their lives from someone who's abusing them. That's how privacy works in the kind of small, literally in people's houses, smaller places. And then you can scale all the way, you know, halfway, which privacy is how we get protection from the corporations who increasingly want to use all the information they know about us to, say, decide how much we're going to pay for things and maximize how much we might want to pay, or decide what options we get when we're searching for a job, and those kinds of things that are more on the commercial side. But just as important, they have more power because they know more about us and they can leverage that power against us. And then out a little bigger, and you think about your role as a citizen, you know, we have the private vote in America. We have a secret ballot. We have a secret ballot so that powerful people can't force you to vote for the person they want you to vote for. So it's your decision, not theirs. And those powerful people could be anywhere from your husband to your employer to the government in power. But that's why we have a private ballot, we call it a secret ballot, a private ballot in the United States. But it's also the way that people organize to make change. Every public fight for social justice in the United States has needed to have a private space for it to grow. And, you know, in my lifetime, we've watched gay rights, for instance, go from something that really people had to talk about in private because it was not popular and was not recognized. And people could, you know, literally be attacked for standing up for these things, to the place where, you know, hopefully we can keep it, but the United States Supreme Court has recognized gay marriage and gay people have rights that are much closer to what they deserve than they had when this started out. But every public fight for people's rights has had to have a private dimension, especially in the early days. And I think people are seeing that now in the current administration, maybe a little more than they did in the past. People are recognizing that, you know, you need to use a privacy protective tool in order to organize and plan things, because otherwise it will get intercepted and interrupted by people with more power who want to make sure that we all stay weak and powerless and unable to make changes to our government. So that's how I think of privacy. And then it's interwoven with free speech. I mean, free speech doctrine in the United States has always protected the right to anonymous speech. It's always protected the right of people to organize and associate in private. You know, there's a very famous Supreme Court case from the 1950s where the NAACP was ordered by the state of Alabama to turn over its membership lists. And the Supreme Court said, people deserve to be able to organize to make social change, and nobody will join an organization to do that if they know their identities are getting turned over to hostile governments. And so the case is called NAACP versus Alabama, and it really set the standard for why privacy and free speech are in many ways intertwined.
What you were saying triggered for me something, a question that is pretty specific to women, which is that states aren't allowed to ask for private membership lists, but multiple Republican-led states now are demanding medical records of women.
Yes.
So how does that go in with the privacy issue and the fact that privacy is not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, whereas freedom of speech is?
I think that it's something we need to fight back hard against. I think that when the Fourth Amendment says you deserve to be secure in your papers, your home, and your effects, that's what it means. But we don't have the Supreme Court interpreting it that way as much as we should right now. And that's some of the work that EFF and others are doing in the courts, but that really we do need people to recognize that, you know, the word privacy doesn't have to be in the Constitution. Privacy protective ideas are woven throughout our Constitution. And they can exist in statutes even if they're not in the Constitution. And we're seeing attacks on it right now. I think those reproductive fights are huge ones. And we need to stand up and fight back because it's not right. I don't think it's constitutional. And people are, I think, especially after the Dobbs decision and the repeal of Roe versus Wade, a lot more women are really waking, women and people who love them are waking up to the fact that we don't have enough privacy in our communications and in our health records, and we need to step up and do more. The stories are horrific, right? There's a woman in Nebraska who is serving 2 years in prison for having a conversation over Facebook messages with her daughter to help her daughter get an abortion. If that communication had happened on a more private channel rather than Facebook Messenger without encryption, she might not be in jail today. I mean, these are literally, this isn't like an abstract, I wish I had a little more privacy moments. This is actually about people's security and people's ability to live their lives.
I know I've read that some people believe that it was a mistake to base Roe v. Wade on privacy, because that was, they said, weaker because it's not explicitly in the Constitution. And so they pulled down Roe v. Wade, and that was the protection against states that are more willing to erode women's rights over their own privacy, their own data.
Look, I have to say that I think the people who wanted to get rid of Roe versus Wade would have done it regardless of what the legal theory was, whether you were going under an equal protection claim or another one. I think it's a little naive of folks who are kind of legal strategies to think that one strategy would have won where the other strategy lost so badly. I mean, I think the answer to that is that we need to shore up privacy even more, not to abandon privacy as a thing we care about, because we don't have tools right now written down in the way that we might want to. But I also think there's a way to look at the Constitution in a way that does protect privacy, and that's another pathway as well. I mean, I'm not really, like, I don't care how we protect people. I just want to protect people. So I'm less worried about what legal theory protects people than I am that we try all of them and we try to get people protected. So to me, privacy is important, not as privacy. Privacy is important because it stops that mother in Nebraska from going to jail. If some other legal theory would have kept her free, let's do that too. But I think that privacy isn't a wrong way to frame what's going on, and the way that the lack of privacy is causing a lot of damage right now and a lot of risk.
I don't think it's a random coincidence that the time when they're more able to go after things like medical records is also the time that all of this, on the good side, all of this information sharing has become incredibly easy. Like, I log into my health portal and my doctors who are in different systems are all there, and they can all cross-check my information. And that's great, right?
Yeah.
That's part of why our modern healthcare is so amazing in many ways. But the easy sharing of data, that took a click, you know? I just clicked a box and said, yes, do it.
Yeah. I mean, this is how the system is not structured well, right? I mean, I love technology. I love the benefits that technology can give to us. But the fact that we can click a box that says, oh, I hereby waive not only my privacy rights, but I want to be able to do blah, 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 blah. Like, it's all mushed together in one click box, right? Like, that's not okay. We need to have all the tools, and we need to have the legal and policy structures that stand with us for those tools as well. And some of that information sharing should be a lot harder or a lot clearer to people about what they're doing, a lot harder to have just one click box mean, 20 million different things at once, some of which are important and some of which are unimportant. I just think that there's a way we can structure the world so that we can have the benefits of technology without so much of the bad sides. I mean, nobody came down off of a mountain with stone tablets that said the only way to make money off the internet is to spy on people. Right. And yet that seems to be the predominant business model. Well, that may take some law that says, you know, you can't have surveillance as a business model anymore. The health records one can be a little harder, and I think it may be a little more about enforcing real constraints. You know, the big healthcare law called HIPAA that people may hear about a lot, that only applies to medical providers. It doesn't apply to people who give you a tracker for your periods or other kinds of things. Like, we need to broaden the scope of that, and we might need to revisit it. It was written quite a long time ago now, and the technology has changed. But I think the goal ought to be to protect users and give them new technologies. And I think that's doable in maybe 90% of the problems that we're all facing right now. And then there's the hard 10%.
Yeah, it would be nice if we could just, you know, get the 90% done. But of course, we do have the Congress we have, which is not only that the Republicans are dominating, but that there is this real, to me, I see a real fear to address the big issues that technology has brought into our lives. Do you see that as well?
I mean, I actually think that they're willing to wade in some really unfortunate ways. So it's not like they stay, you know, in the 90s when I started doing this, you know, we would show up and I kind of felt like I'm the lawyer from the future, you know, and we would explain how stuff worked at a very fundamental level to people. Now we go in and there are people whispering in their ears on the other side about, you know, why us not having privacy is great. And we have to explain why us having privacy and control is better than a world in which the corporations have all this control. So, you know, I don't like that sometimes that takes Congress to a standstill. And it's definitely the case for comprehensive privacy legislation that by the time it gets in front of Congress, it's been watered down so much it's not even good. You know, the last thing that was proposed federally for a comprehensive privacy protection was worse than what we have in California right now. And the whole goal and the reason the companies were behind it was because it was a step backwards from what, you know, they have in California, which is a very large state. So you have to watch. Just because they call it privacy doesn't mean that it's privacy. But we have to keep pushing, because otherwise we're just surrendering to this surveillance state. And at this point, it's starting to put people who care about reproductive support in jail and sweep up our neighbors and deport them. So it's not like if we ignore this problem and just say, oh, Congress is helpless, that it's going to go away. It's going to get worse. So we have to engage.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some specific things that people do online where women might have different or more specific concerns than men, women and other, I just say, and vulnerable minorities, because it's not just women, but it's transgender people, people of color, people of minority religions as well. But primarily talking about women, what are some of the places where you see that women have specific concerns with their online life self?
I mean, I think that the one we've talked about a little bit already now is in reproductive care. And it's not just women. People who are seeking reproductive assistance need access to information. And we're seeing increasing censorship of that information by the sources that people normally go to, whether that's social media or even private websites. EFF just did a big report about censorship of reproductive information. And we found that even though the terms of a lot of these companies would, on their surface, mean that this information is available, and of course it's First Amendment protected, people were having access problems. People were having their websites taken down. People were having their Facebook groups taken down. And so there's even in the context of what's legal, there's a gap between what these companies say they're doing and what they're actually doing as a result, I think, largely of pressure, outside pressure.
I did look at that, and I was just amazed at how specific the people who wrote it were able to get in how you address these issues specifically with what words you can use and what Meta might be targeting to not necessarily take down, but also just they've got their hand on the throttle too.
Yes. Yep. So stuff is even if it's theoretically there, it's really hard to get to find. So this is one of these ways that censorship and privacy are very intertwined, and people are having trouble accessing information, as I mentioned already. Also, people are being prosecuted and tracked down based upon their online footprint or even their offline footprint. Things like license plate readers and other offline surveillance are disproportionately aimed at people who are seeking reproductive care, which is a lot of women, and the people who want to help them, which is also a lot of women. So this is a specific area where I think women just seeking healthcare information or healthcare are finding that the lack of privacy and the censorship issues are getting in the way. I already mentioned also about domestic violence victims and people who are facing malware and other kinds of, you know, more targeted tracking of their behavior by people who want to control them.
Hi, podcast listeners, Suki here. My hope is always to continue to improve and expand the reach of the Babblery, so I'm asking for your help. If you like what I'm doing here, please leave a review in your favorite podcast app. And if you have feedback about the podcast version, which can be quite different from the broadcast version, I'd love to hear from you at suki@ksqd.org. Speaking of KSQD, our spring pledge drive just ended. Please support community radio. Give a donation to KSQD or your local station. Community radio won't always please you, but it represents your community better than corporate media ever could. Give a donation at ksqd.org or support the Babblery on Substack or Patreon. Back to the show. This is your host, Suki Wessling. Cindy Cohen of the Electronic Frontier Foundation has spent a career fighting on the front lines for the right of internet users to maintain freedom of speech and privacy. Some feminists have argued that these rights conflict directly with the right of women to be safe from harm. Cindy doesn't see it that way. As a lawyer, she considers that the internet is built on top of a legal system that already wasn't designed to serve women's needs.
This is an ongoing issue, and EFF does a lot of work to try to help people figure out when that's happened to them and have recourse to other techniques to protect themselves. So those are definitely areas in which I think women are disproportionately represented in the victims of this, but it's marginalized people as well who are also disproportionately represented in that. In those scenarios. So those are a couple of areas. We also see, you know, a lot of online harassment and targeting really is aimed at women. EFF has worked with groups around the world to try to put together security trainings for people. And one of the people who I talk to on my podcast is a woman who trains women in East Africa about all the techniques they can use to help protect themselves online against harassment, whether that harassment is due from somebody in their own home or somebody outside. So the surveillance self-defense materials are a good place for people to start to kind of set things up to help protect themselves, to be able to get access to the information they need to communicate without having this risk of attack.
And, you know, you mentioned the online abuse, and that's something that I know has been a particularly different scenario for men and women. Yeah. When it comes to social media and also releasing any of your work online, podcasters, writers, video artists, whoever, that when men do something, people who are coded male, they do get abuse because there are a lot of, unfortunately, very rude people. But women don't just get abuse, they get very specific targeted abuse. So a man might get, you know, you're such a stupid idiot, whatever, something like that. Whereas a woman might get, I'm going to come to your house, you know, very specific threats against women's bodies. Can you talk a little bit about what that does to freedom of speech? Because, of course, we have the privacy, the ability to be online and be somewhat anonymous. Many people are using their real names, but they feel anonymous, and so they behave differently. But then that man who's threatening that woman is using his freedom of speech to really curtail her freedom of speech, because she's going to be less willing to open herself up to that sort of abuse.
You know, we took an offline problem where women's protection and women's protection from abuse was not handled seriously by law enforcement and people in power. And we moved it over into the online world, and we're experiencing the same kind of situation in which people whose job it is to help protect us and keep us safe from abuse are rotten at it in the offline world, and they're rotten at it in the online world. And I just think it's really important. Like, women have had to publish under pseudonyms for years, right? Because of things like that. So I think that you know, one of the problems is there's just not very much recourse offline or online to women being harassed by the, and you're right. It's a, you know, I don't think the problem is that all men are bad. It's a problem that a few men are really doing a lot of damage. I think you're not wrong about that. I don't have the demographic information in front of me. And so your ability to come after an abuser and get them to stop is, the tools are not great, right? And they need to be better. Like, you need to be able to get a restraining order against someone for online behavior and have it stick. And again, the problem of restraining orders not working very well is not an online problem. It's a problem in general of the way our society is slanted against these kinds of, you know, in ways that protect this kind of abuse. And so, you know, I tend to look at that, like, what are the tools that, how can we make those tools better so that they're actually available, so that women who are facing this kind of things just don't get shrugged at by the law enforcement if these are actual threats, or on these online communities. I think the other thing that we believe strongly in is having a multitude of places where you can speak and participate. So if one isn't serving you, you can go somewhere else without losing your whole community. This is the kind of the history of some of, you know, part of the reason why EFF is very supportive of some of the communities like Mastodon or Blue Sky or other kinds of communities that are not corporate controlled and have a surveillance business model, is to let people be able to build communities that serve them rather than being, you know, stuck in these huge communities where there's a lot of abusers. And we, you know, we've seen an exodus of people, of women especially, off of X, because there's so much abuse there. And luckily, there's some other places that they can go where it's less. It's still not great, but it's better. And I just think that the world in which there are two or three commercial privacy-invasive products that try to do content moderation for the whole world, it's never going to work very well. Content moderation at scale is not going to work very well. So what do we need to do? We don't need to make the dictators nicer dictators. We need to get rid of dictators and have multiple options for people. I just think that expecting Mark Zuckerberg to get magically better at protecting women online, even if he wanted to, and I don't know, is going to be hard because of just the sheer scale and the difficulty of doing content moderation at scale. And doing it in a way that doesn't throw the babies out with the bathwater. The other problem with this is the way that some of these companies are starting to be pushed towards limiting what people can say online isn't in the ways that maybe, you know, you and I would write if we got asked to write it. It's in the hands of the people in power. And right now, what does that mean? That means marginalized people are getting over-censored, even while the people who are the actual people that I think you and I might agree with need more censorship or not. So you have to be careful if you're going to create a censorship magic wand. You also have to look at who you're handing it to. And I think that this is another reason why we want a multiplicity of places where people can build safe communities for themselves rather than creating a big censorship stick and handing it to anybody, but certainly not the current federal government.
So how do you see the conflict, or maybe you don't see it as a conflict, and I'd love to hear how you describe it, between privacy, which allows an abuser, an online abuser, to be completely anonymous, to use a VPN so they can't be traced, et cetera, and the freedom of speech of vulnerable groups who that person, as soon as, you know, yes, we have great blocking tools. I write on Substack and I love their moderation tools. But that guy can just become somebody else within 30 seconds. And how do we deal with that dilemma?
Well, I mean, look, they have done scientific research about anonymity. And we have a gigantic example in front of us, which is Facebook, right? Which requires real names. People aren't nicer to each other. This idea that anonymous speech allows people to be meaner to each other or to harass people more isn't actually borne out by the research. And I don't think it's actually borne out if people step back and look at it. People aren't nicer to each other on Facebook than they are on other platforms. So I think even our lived experience, if you step back and think about it, is not consistent with this idea that anonymity is the problem. Right now, we have people who harass with impunity. You can find them. It's not actually all that hard to find most of them. I mean, the number of people who can legitimately handle being untraceable online if they're engaging in a campaign and harassment, it's very small. It's that they're not being caught. It's that nobody's trying to catch them. It's that the cops say, oh, there's a VPN, there's nothing I can do. Of course there is. When they're trying to go after drug dealers, they can go past a VPN, right? Like, so I just think it's a problem of will and enforcement and not a problem of the technology. It's because historically, women's concerns about harassment haven't been taken seriously by the people who are supposed to protect us. And I think until we address that problem, all the getting rid of anonymity in the world is going to end up hurting those marginalized people. Look, EFF does human rights work all around the world. The ability to sneak information out of a repressive government and using anonymity, VPNs, tools like Tor, it saves lives. We wouldn't know the things we know about the Taiwanese fight for freedom. Tibet, we work with a lot of Chinese democracy people. Now we've got people in Ukraine. We've got people in Gaza. We've got people, I mean, all over the world, Sudan, people all over the world who need to get information out of very scary places where there is official censorship. They need these tools and they rely on these tools. And if we decide that, you know, because cops aren't willing to investigate harassment, we're going to get rid of these tools, I think we're cutting off the people we're hurting. We're never going to, you know, it's not the right move to remove anonymity from everybody because some people misuse it. We have other tools to deal with abusers, but lots of people would like you to think that there's a technological fix for this. And if we just remove anonymity online, it'll all be well. I'm here to tell you, I don't think that's going to work. And you're going to hurt a lot of people along the way. And some of those are the same people you think you're helping.
I wanted to talk a little bit about something that is near and dear to a lot of women's hearts. And I'm not being sexist here, online shopping. and the reason I'm not being sexist, for one, is that data shows that women do most of the buying when you're talking about a household. When you're talking about individual behavior, it's really interesting. People buying just for themselves, men buy more. Women hardly ever buy just for themselves, despite sexist beliefs about women's behavior. Yeah. So, you know, online shopping, you've mentioned the tracking a bit. And talk a little bit about what you would like to see, because right now I don't know how many listeners are aware of how much they're being tracked, but some of it is pretty shocking in how sophisticated it is, how much they know about you. And the whole idea about we're anonymizing this, you know, you can speak about that, but they know a lot about us.
They do. You know, there's a lot of tracking of us. There's also a lot of analysis of other people like us and people who we communicate with. It's not just I think sometimes, you know, I often get the, oh, my phone must be listening to me because I was talking to my friend about, you know, this shirt. And the next thing you know, I got an app for the shirt. And, you know, I always kind of have a good news, bad news answer to that. The good news is they're probably not listening to you on your phone. And the bad news is they don't have to, because you're not that unique. And the other people's preferences, people are micro created into these little categories. And so you end up getting the ad for the thing you were talking about, not because you're the only person in the world who talks about it, but because you're not the only person in the world who talks about it. And people tend to be segmented. So again, the good news, bad news is the bad news, the good news is they're not tracking you individually at that level very much. The bad news is they don't have to, because they've got you segmented into, you know, mom with two dogs and, you know, a bad chewy habit, which would probably be me. But the result for you is the same, which is you are tracked, and that tracking is organized and analyzed in ways that are increasingly marshaled against you. And we're beginning to see, I think people are beginning to see a lot more clearly the against you part of that, where we're starting to see what we call price discrimination. That's what economists call it, where the amount that you pay for something is based upon the fact that the companies who are charging you have all this other information about you and your ability to pay and your desperation for the thing that leads to you being charged a higher price than you might otherwise be charged. We just saw a report out of the New York Times about this, about home insurance, where people's credit rating was being used to decide as part of deciding how much they paid for home insurance. And what they decided is if you've got poor credit, they can charge you more for home insurance and you will pay it, because you don't have the ability to switch your insurance companies very easily. They know that you will pay more for home insurance if you've got a weaker credit score. I suspect in other situations it might be flipped, where if they know you've got more money, they're going to charge you more for certain things. But, you know, I think that strikes a lot of people as really unfair. And it's a result of this surveillance business model kind of coming to its natural conclusion. Now that they've got all this information, they're tracking us all the time, and they've got the analytical ability to set prices, you know, dynamically, and they don't have to set one price for everyone. They're going to start trying to maximize how much they can pull out of your wallet for each transaction. And we're starting to see that more. Of course, we see it on the other side as well, which is the kinds of things you get ads for are based upon who they think you are. And there's a famous, somewhat dated now, Facebook story about how women who were doing job searches on Facebook would not see ads for CEOs or higher paid jobs. They'd see ads for housekeepers and secretaries and things that are traditionally female jobs. And I don't think it's because Facebook was evil. It's because when you feed in data about the jobs that people have traditionally had, it's going to spit out the same jobs. And they saw people of color were, you know, they got ads for being janitors rather than ads for being, you know, senior executives. And so, you know, that's another area where the fact that they're tracking who we are results in, you know, really, I think, horrifically discriminatory experiences online that can really affect us. They can affect, do we qualify for a mortgage? How much do we pay for things? You know, all sorts of things. And then you add the government in there with the amount of data that it collects, and they're making decisions based on whether you can keep your kids or not, or whether you qualify for disability or not, and those kinds of things as well that really impact people's lives in a real way.
This is your host, Suki Wessling. Every time I have a conversation about the internet and freedom of speech, I feel torn in half. I completely agree with privacy and free speech advocates that we're better off as a society when people are free to speak their minds and have guaranteed privacy in their homes and organizations. But I also believe deeply in the old-fashioned social mores that allowed people of different backgrounds, different faiths, and different political beliefs to work, play, and vote together. The modern internet has destroyed any sense that Americans had that we are a fundamentally decent society, even after we've taken into account the many problems with bias, violence, and discrimination that predated the online world. When you see what people are willing to do and say to each other online, it's enough to make the most optimistic of us want to go live in a cave. And now here comes an amplifier for our internet woes, artificial intelligence. Electronic Frontier Foundation's Cindy Cohen and I talked about some ideas for reining it in. It seems like what we have in the real world is so flawed that when it goes online, it almost gets magnified. In the age of AI, it is getting magnified.
Absolutely. It gets supercharged.
Yeah. AI looks at the whole of human output, and the whole of human output is full of racism, sexism, all sorts of things that we wouldn't really want the AI to be if it were truly the intelligent being that we pretend that it is. But instead, it's just crunching all that data and saying, well, this is the most likely thing. If you're Black, you're more likely to be a janitor.
Yeah. And you look, there's a whole field of AI research called alignment and other kinds of things that are trying to combat that, but they're kind of trying to put a Band-Aid on something and adjust it. So it's a little more complicated, and there are plenty of good researchers who are trying to get back to, to avoid the worst of these abuses. But it's hard to predict where they're going to show up, and it's hard to marshal the resources to fix them. And so it's a weird world to be in. I mean, one of the things, and this is kind of more on the governmental side, but like, I don't think that the government should be able to deploy these new techniques against us until we as a society decide yes. Right now, the default is they deploy it, and then we find out later, and then we try to like fix it on the back end. And I think one just flip where deployment can't happen until after public consultation would help us with a lot on the government side. And it's a lot easier to do on the government side because we have, you know, things called like the Administrative Procedures Act and stuff like that, that already constrain the government in the same way. But I think for private companies as well, some kind of a version where, you know, we're not the guinea pigs that they try this out on and then sort out later what works or not. Some kinds of ways to have public input into these things could be a helpful way to get started on, you know, riding the ship. I mean, I think that's useful. I think a comprehensive privacy law that just says you don't get to spy on people as your business model would be another way to go about it, and maybe a little quicker.
One issue of particular interest to me is what online freedoms are doing to children. It's a lovely idea that parents should exert more control over what their kids see and who they communicate with online, but the reality is that parents feel helpless, and in many ways are helpless. I brought up children's access to pornography, which first elicited a confusing back and forth. One last online question, which is one that I think is really it's a test case for how far privacy goes, which is online pornography and kids. And some states have enacted laws trying to get such sites to age verify their visitors. But that immediately, they all do now? Okay.
I mean, if it's porn, they almost all do.
The key word here is almost. After our conversation, I looked up the stats. As of this recording, only 16 U.S. states had a law requiring age verification for porn sites. And as we know, porn slips out of the confines of dedicated websites the way flashers used to slip out of peep shows and onto a crowded street. A 2022 report from Common Sense Media says that 52% of teens report having seen online depictions of violent sexual acts against women, which is, any way you look at it, a serious problem. But Cindy Cohen's focus is on the potential harm stemming from the proposed solutions to this problem. What happens when we allow restrictions in the name of protecting children?
What they're trying to do is to say age appropriate for anything that might be harmful to kids. And that's a much broader term, and it includes things where I don't think everybody agrees. You know, if you go to a red state and you talk to conservative people, they don't think having access to LGBTQ content or trans content, they think that harms kids. So I think that the thing that we're fighting now with a lot of the age gating is this idea that some stuff is harmful to kids, and that's a much broader category. And it's why EFF is so concerned and think it's a really bad idea, because if we don't have a shared agreement about what's harmful to kids, then you're just handing a censorship tool to people. And porn, you know, some porn is First Amendment protected and some isn't. Like, again, we don't even agree what porn is. And so you can get really tricky. Like, we've spent years trying to help women who have breastfeeding forums continue to have their forums when they get flagged for nudity because somebody's taking a picture and saying, like, she's not latching. How does this work? Or I've got this, you know, rash or something. What does this look like? And they get flagged as pornography. So again, I think that we have to be really careful when we think about how we want to respond to these problems. And it's quite often women who end up getting sideswiped worse by these kinds of things, because women's bodies are both really important, and a lot of women's health depends on us being able to be honest about our bodies. And it gets labeled pornography by a set of people who, if they're in charge, that's what happens. And I've spent probably the most consistent amount of time over the 25 years I've been at EFF trying to make sure that women can talk about breastfeeding online, as I've done almost anything else, because it's a low-level problem, low as in it's not always, you know, high, but it continues across all sorts of forums because of society's uncomfortableness with women's bodies.
Listening to Cindy's reasoning, there was a lot that I agreed with, but in the interests of allowing her time to get ready to go duke it out with Jon Stewart on The Daily Show later that afternoon, I decided that I will have to remain torn on this issue. We moved on to the subject of Cindy's delightful legal memoir, Privacy's Defender.
A couple of reasons for wanting to write the book. I will say one of them is that I started looking at the histories of especially the 1990s internet, the early internet, and of course the internet's older, but the kind of, you know, the introduction of the widely available internet with the World Wide Web and things like that, that all happened in the 90s. And all these stories were about men and the businesses that they started, right? And like, don't get me wrong, they were there, right? Jobs and Gates and even EFF founder Mitch Kapor, like, you know, white guys founded a lot of businesses in the 90s around tech. Great. I was around then too, and it just felt like a very narrow version of what were very rich times. And I was complaining about this. And I had some people say, you know, why don't you put your keyboard where your mouth is, right? Why don't you tell your story if that's, you know, if that's frustrating to you? And so that was one of the original impetus for me to begin to write, like, what it was like for me in the 90s to be part of trying to stand up for privacy and innovation online. So that was the first part. Also, the story is written as if there aren't any other women either. It's not just me, you know, the story of us freeing up encryption features two very, very amazing forward-looking women judges who saw the future of the internet and were willing to do it, even though I suspect neither of them were particularly technical. So it wasn't just me. There was a cadre of us, and some of them wore black robes that helped usher in some of the privacy and security that we do enjoy on the internet now. We don't have enough, but we have a lot more than we would have had. So that was one reason. I think the other reason is to, you know, I was lucky enough to get to do this kind of work for a long time. I thought it was important to share how you do this kind of work for the long run. What are the things I've learned along the way? Because I think it's important to understand that this kind of work is not like a TV show where, you know, it's, you know, by the third set of commercials, it's all done, right? These are long-term fights, and hopefully recruit some other people to think that they can spend their lives doing this kind of work, and not just digital privacy, although of course I care about that a lot, but really devoting your life to making the world a better place and being part of the team of people who are pushing in various ways to try to make the world better. That's a viable life and a good life, and one that doesn't require you to be special. It just requires you to decide you want to do it and find ways to do it.
I asked Cindy about her decision to write about her personal life in a book that is otherwise focused on three important legal cases that form the foundation of privacy and freedom of speech protections on the internet.
First of all, I decided to make it a first-person memoir, professional memoir, because I feel like there's a lot of people who can write about privacy and these fights really well from a journalistic perspective or an academic perspective, but I lived it. I did this work. And so as a practitioner, I wanted to kind of take people along and put them on my shoulder as we put these cases together and figured the things out. And then I decided to talk about my personal life for a couple of reasons. One is I felt like if I really wanted to inspire people about doing this kind of work, I should include the ways in which it enriched my personal life as well, because I think it makes it more engaging and it makes it seem more possible for people. Again, I'm not an extraordinary person, and I'm just an ordinary person who wanted to do the right thing. And I felt like putting that in there was helpful to personalize it and make it feel a little more grounded. It's also just the case that some pretty strange and amazing things happened to me as a result of my work, right? I was adopted and I met my birth family because of my work. I met both my first husband and my second husband as a side effect, you know, as part of the work. And I just felt like that added some richness to the story and might make it more approachable to people who aren't already, you know, deep law or deep tech or deep policy people, but really make it relatable to folks who don't come from, you know, any of those worlds and make it interesting for them to read as well.
I really liked how you wove through your relationship with your mom, that you had a difficult period in your childhood with her mental illness, and then how she came to be your personal wardrobe specialist.
She was. I'm telling you, I got asked to be on The Daily Show, and I spent a crazy afternoon because I didn't feel like I had the right pants. And I just had her with me. I like went around. I'm like, I have to have the right pants. Norma would not want me to go on TV on jeans. And I only happened to have jeans with me. Anyway, so I just had a couple days ago when I was shopping, I had a little moment where I was missing her terribly because she's long passed away, but also just feeling like I had her with me at the same time. And yeah, you know, she didn't understand what I did. She was a lovely, lovely person. She was afraid of ATMs her whole life. You know, she was not a technical person. You know, we have to go and like convince her that, you know, she had a regular phone, like she wouldn't get a cell phone until pretty late. And you know, she's older too. You know, she's passed away now. But so she didn't understand this crazy thing I was doing, but she knew what to do to support me from where she was. And one of the ways she supported me was she always made sure that I had the clothes I needed to go to court or to do whatever I was doing. And that was really the way she showed her love.
And the other thing was, I really appreciated that you chose to share what is clearly a mostly positive account of your adoption. Because so much of what is online and in memoirs is about problems with adoption. Yeah. And your story is just beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. You know, I was able to meet my birth grandfather and aunt and get to spend a chunk of time with them. Even though my birth mother, she still doesn't want to talk to me. I understand where she was coming from. I suspect that that whole time in the 60s, this was really a horrific time for her, but it was hard and it was painful. And I owe such a debt to a woman who was really my birth mother's best friend who made the connection and connected me. But yeah, I was able to do that. And the thing that I learned out of it was not only, you know, the amazing connection that I felt to my birth family, but it really deepened my connection to my adoptive family too, because, you know, especially my brother and sister, but even both of my parents, I was terrified to tell my parents that I was interested in looking for my birth family. I didn't know how they would take it. And they were both just so supportive because they understood, and they also, they weren't threatened. They knew I loved them. And so it really ended up deepening things in both directions. And I'm really just grateful that whole thing came out of it that way. Thank you for your kind words.
It seems like your story, although the story in your book is about these fights that with some wins, some losses, a lot of work left to do, is also just a really optimistic portrait of what the internet has given us and can give us. So I wondered if you would just speak a little bit about that, the things that you feel are positive about our online lives and what we're getting from it and what we can do with it.
Look, there are real problems. And I, you know, obviously I've spent my life trying to fight for a better online world, and we have not finished with what we're doing. But sometimes I think it's easy to miss what we've gained. You know, you and I'm in New York City, and I think you're in Santa Cruz, and we are having a real-time conversation that I'm not worried about how much this is going to cost me, right? Like, you know, I lived in a time when you counted the minutes, right? Because if you spent more than 3 minutes on a call, it got really, really expensive. That really limited the ability of people to organize, to communicate, to connect across distance. The ability to do things kind of asynchronous, right? Where we can have these ongoing chats with the people we love that, like, the, you know, it's not the same as writing letters or even having a call. It's a whole new way for people to stay connected that didn't exist, you know, in the same way before we had this. I'm watching all of the organizing that's happening right now against the ICE and the other excesses of this administration. It's all organized, you know, online, even if there's offline in-person things, which are really important. It's a mix. It's not one or the other, right? And they feed each other, and people are using the tools. I wish that more people were able to use more private tools, but that's happening. This organizing is being made possible because of the digital network. So I still am excited about the prospect of that. We have to fight. You know, John Perry Barlow once told me, no one gives you your rights, you have to take them. And I think that that's a lot of my framing about it. We have a lot of work to do. But I do think that in some ways we've kind of metastasized a lot of the benefits that the internet gave us, and we're all sometimes only focused on the problems. And it's not like the problems aren't there, but it's also not like the benefits aren't there. And what we need is all of these tools to work for us. And they can. If we can get rid of this surveillance business model, I think we can shrink a lot of things down to a better problem. That's not hard to do. I mean, it's hard to do politically, but compared to, you know, giving women the vote or ending slavery, like, it's not, we've solved harder problems. And so, you know, my hope is that we can continue to push forward and get ourselves out of this, I think, hole that we're in right now. But I don't think we're going to get out of it without tech. I do sometimes hear from people who say, oh, well, we should just all get off tech and go back there. And I think that's a very privileged position. Honestly, you know, like, if you have the ability to go live in the woods all by yourself and not need tech anymore, you know, God bless you, go with God. But most people don't, and they don't for good reason. And so I think that it's not really an option. We need to build a better tech world. There may be some technologies we say no to. That's, I don't mean all tech is always good tech, but in the main, the internet, I think, has done a lot of good. And now we have to work to make sure that it's on our side, because it's increasingly being marshaled against us. But I think we could do it. And I honestly don't really think we have much of a choice. We have to fight for a better world.
Cindy Cohen is retiring from her post as executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation soon after this episode premieres. Many thanks to Cindy for sharing her life, work, and perspective with me. You can access links to related information in the show notes on babbelry.com. The song Silence is by Unwoman at unwoman.com. Thanks for listening. Forever.
You've been listening to The Babbelry.
The Babbelry is produced with support from KSQD Radio in Santa Cruz, California.
Find us on major podcast platforms or at babbley.com.